Chapter 7, How the Adventure Ended. So we ended kind of on a little cliffhanger there. Mm-hmm. That we ended with Chapter 6 last week, where Eustace had kind of an adventure all by himself. We are now off into truly uncharted territory, and they have survived a wicked storm, and they have finally made land. The poor ship has been bruised and battered, and now they can sort of resupply with food and water and wood and all sorts of things. Eustace, being Eustace, decides to scamper off by himself, and what happens?
Well, he sleeps in a dragon's cave and turns into a dragon.
So his dragonish thoughts on top of a dragon's horde, and he transforms into a dragon. The chapter that we read last week ended then with Eustace the dragon now, I'm not going to say reunited, but almost confronting Caspian, Lucy, and Edmund, and everyone else. Yeah. This is the first time they've seen him. They saw a dragon flying around. They were obviously quite alarmed at that. The dragon approaches them, and they get ready for battle, thinking that, well, I mean, that's what you do against dragons. And the chapter ends them face to face with this dragon, and all of a sudden Caspian says, "But look," he notices that this dragon is wearing a very familiar bracelet.
Right. Yes.
So if that chapter was Eustace's adventure, we are now going to see how that adventure found its conclusion. So what was so notable to Caspian about the bracelet?
It had crest on or something on it that made it Narnia.
Yes.
Excuse me.
Right.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, not just Narnian, but it had the crest of a family.
Yes.
And he can identify it. Who is it?
Octesian.
So Lord Octesian's arm ring.
Yeah.
So what goes through the minds of the party, noting that this dragon is in possession of Lord Octesian's arm ring? Right. Yeah. So that's what, you know, dragons are bad guys, and you've eaten this guy we're looking for, so have at you. And, you know, he's ready to avenge Lord Octesian's death.
But he found it and shook his head at him.
Aha. So the dragon understands them, shakes his head no. Now, who gets the idea that it might be something more than just an ordinary dragon?
Lucy does.
And what is her thought?
He might be an
This might be a person under enchantment. Now, interestingly enough, in the last chapter, when all this is happening to Eustace, a comment is made that because he didn't read the right sort of books, he had no way to explain what was happening, and he wouldn't have even recognized the name dragon. Why does Lucy come up with the actual sort of mysterious solution to this?
She read the right
books. She's probably read the right sort of books. So instead of reading, as a child, instead of reading, you know, dull nonfiction books in order to impress people with your trivial knowledge, she probably read fairy tales and fantasy stories and stuff that she not only enjoyed, but nurtured her soul and her intellect, and she knows a little something about dragons, and she figures out this could be a person. So, how does the dragon respond?
He's not shakes his head back and forth.
Well, yes, it's a person, but no, I am not who?
Octesian.
I am not Lord Octesian, because that would have been the first guess.
Right.
You know, if you're wearing the bracelet and you are an enchanted person who's been transformed into a dragon, well, maybe you're the guy who owned the bracelet.
Yeah.
But no such luck.
But they didn't know that he was human.
So they now know that there's a person under enchantment here. It is not the Lord Octesian, and then all of a sudden they realize it is
Lucy asked him. Lucy, they didn't know which one asked him. He shook his head.
It is Eustace. Now, how does Eustace the dragon react to being identified as Eustace?
Shaking his head very,
very violently.
Yeah, bumping his tail. He's pretty happy that he's been now.
And boiling tears which flowed from his eyes. So he is both happy they figured it out, and he is also despondent. You know, this curse. And he is brokenhearted. So how does everyone treat the enchanted Eustace?
Well, they're all with him. They let him know that they'll be there, and they won't leave him. Yeah,
everyone is
supportive.
Kind of everyone's there. Support. You know. Yeah. Well, you know, it'll be all right, and you know, tough luck. And I mean, they want to be supportive for him.
And he helped them too at that point.
That's right.
He's already being nicer as a dragon than he ever was as a boy.
That's right. So how does Eustace become helpful as a dragon?
He flies around and he brings back food for them.
Okay.
And then he brings back a tree that they can make a mast out of.
Right. Now these are all things that either they could not do on their own or would take them an enormous amount of time and effort.
Right.
He's able to scope out the island very quickly. He's able to find them food, dispatch them very humanely. He is able to yank up a giant tree from its roots and bring it back to them.
He likes to give rides, too.
He even gives rides. That's right. What else is he doing?
He keeps them warm
at night.
Yeah.
So he's like his own little furnace.
Yeah.
And there on the cold beach, people sort of snuggle up to him like a living water bottle.
Yeah.
I've never used a hot water bottle, but let's say a heating pad. So, how is Eustace liking this new interaction with everyone?
He said it was keeping him from total despair.
Okay, so I think that's a good balance. That he does like it, but he's also just on the edge of despair. For the first time in his life, he knows what it's like to be cared about and to care for other people, and yet it feels like he has gained this knowledge at a terrible price. Mm-hmm. So he is still quite lonely. He is still feeling very estranged from everyone and everything, even though he feels better about everyone else and even about himself than maybe he ever has. He still feels very alone and apart. And there were times where he would just kind of go off by himself.
He tried to write in the sand, but he couldn't work.
Because the dragon muscles just weren't.
The first place he didn't read and write books.
Once again.
And one of the best social activities, which is eating as a group together, he could not do because he liked his meals raw.
And so he was embarrassed.
Not by himself.
And so, even though everybody's very thankful and grateful for it, he was still constantly reminded that he was not really one of them anymore. Who was his surprise companion?
Reaper Chief
was. So even on those nights where he flew off by himself in loneliness, Reaper Chief would find him and sit with him. What would Reaper Chief do?
Oh,
snuggle to him.
He'd tell him stories.
Yeah.
What kind of stories?
Basically
the stories that he didn't hear from the books that he didn't read, but about, you know, heroes in Narnia, and a lot of them about how these very important people had some sort of terrible downturn, but then in the end, it all worked out. So these sound kind of like fairy tales or fantasy stories that, again, he's never read. And for the first time, he's got a friend, and this friend is telling him that, you know, you're not the first person that has had some low, terrible point in their life that they thought they would never recover from. There have been some very famous people, some very heroic people. Emperors, kings, dukes, knights, poets, lovers, astronomers, philosophers, magicians.
Yep.
And even though it didn't give Eustace a lot of comfort as far as, well, other people got out of a jam, what was a comfort?
Just having Lupita there.
The fact that he did that.
Yeah.
The fact that he did that. It was meant kindly, and Eustace never forgot it. At his lowest point, Reepicheep, who before they were constantly at odds, Reepicheep was there for him and was doing his level best to be comforting and supportive.
Right.
And even if it wasn't exactly what he needed to hear at the time, the fact that he had a friend who cared about him just probably meant the world. You know, we don't see any other talking creatures on this voyage, do we?
No.
They're all men,
yeah,
except for Reepicheep.
Yeah.
He is the only one of his kind.
Yeah.
And maybe Reepicheep sort of understands a little bit of that loneliness. Remember that Reepicheep is often by himself on the ship. Remember earlier in the book, he'd be out in the bow singing the song that he had been taught, or he would be playing chess with somebody like Lucy. These are somewhat solitary, you know, for someone who is so, you know, let's go get them. If you think about it, there's got to come some sort of point where Reepicheep has to realize everyone else is human and I'm not.
That's right.
You know, he can't row.
No,
like the other humans can, because not out of lack of desire or effort, but just simply out of size. These are not mouse-sized oars. So of all of the people to seek Eustace out and give him comfort is the other person there on the voyage who sort of knows what it's like to be part of the group, but always a little different. All right.
That could be the story of our lives.
Yeah, well.
He overheard them talking about how they were going to get him on the ship.
Yeah, now, they've had actually a pretty good several days. They're there for 5-6 days, a week, something like that. And they've been able to eat. They've been able to restock, resupply. They've got that new mask that Eustace has brought. And he has been able to be very helpful. And even if he's still lonely, he's changing. Now, they can't stay there forever. That's not the point.
And they can't take him.
So now the reality of how is this going to work?
He wouldn't fit in.
And he starts overhearing the somewhat concerned whispers of, how do we do this? He's too big to sit on the boat. He would capsize us. I'm not sure he can fly as far as we need to sail. What are we going to do?
They could drag him
in the water.
Now, no one is going to him and saying, we can't take you.
No.
But he's overhearing things. So how must Eustace be feeling?
Wishing he were a dragon.
Worried.
Yeah, I mean, this might be his next lowest point.
Yeah.
You know, that he hits this low, and then he's sort of accepted, he finds some usefulness, he's developing this friendship, but then even that starts having a conclusion, and he starts thinking, well, now it's going to all go away.
Yeah.
So they are nearing the time where they ought to be departing, and who is awake early in the morning?
Edmund
is.
And he saw something.
So what does he see?
He didn't really know at first.
kind of coming out of the fog or the mist.
Yeah,
is it Caspian? No, a little too small to be Caspian. Is it Lucy? No, a little too big to be Lucy. Who is it?
Eustace.
It's Eustace.
And he's got all his, a lot of his stuff. It's all, he's a boy again.
He is a boy again. He is Eustace. And what is Eustace's condition?
Still has a lot of dry
skin.
Yeah,
his feet are dragging, Mike, and he still has stuff on him.
No, that's later.
No.
He's still unsteady.
Yeah.
He seems exhausted or faint. You know, Edmund's got to think, you know, hooray, this amazing, miraculous thing has happened. Let's all celebrate. But what does Eustace want to do? Can we just talk a little bit first? So they sit alone and they talk. And what do they talk about?
Well, he explains how he became a dragon. How he got into the cave and so forth.
Okay.
And then he became undragoned.
Yeah. Okay, how does he become undragoned?
He had help.
He saw a huge lion.
He kept taking his skin off and it didn't work.
Okay, so he sees this huge lion.
Yeah.
Who he's afraid of. Why is he afraid of this lion?
Well, he's afraid he'll get hurt.
I mean, he's a dragon. He's bigger and stronger than any lion. But it's not that kind of fear. It's not the fear that the lion's going to eat him. It's something else. It's almost like it's too much for him.
Also, it's dark at night and there's a light around. There's a light around the
dragon.
It's like moonlight wherever the dragon goes.
Yeah.
Before that, I mean, you were saying that, Marion, is that he's been trying to take the skin off, and every time he takes off a layer.
Well, that's a little bit later. That's a little bit later. He's tried to chew his arm to get the bracelet off, but he hasn't considered the skin yet. So he is there with this dragon, and he is feeling this almost overwhelming sense of dread. And the lion comes up, and he even shuts his eyes as though that would help, but it sort of doesn't help.
And then it spoke to him.
Well.
What does the lion say?
Well, he said to follow him, but he didn't really say it.
Not sure. He's not sure if it was audible or not, but he knew.
Yeah.
He knew that he was supposed to follow the lion. All right. And so, where does the lion take him?
The garden, the top of the mountain,
up into the mountains. Yeah.
Okay. Now, which mountain?
He's not seen this before.
He's been flying all over this island.
Yeah, he'd never seen this.
He's not seen this one before. What is it like?
And it's fruit trees.
The Garden of Eden.
It's
beautiful. And there's fruit trees.
Yeah.
And what's in the middle of it?
A well.
What kind of well?
Water was bubbling up from the bottom.
Okay.
A lot bigger than most wells.
All right. It's this huge, almost like a pool.
With marble steps.
Now, he wants to get in because it looks so inviting and enticing, and it would probably make that bracelet around his arm that's all constricted probably feel better.
Yeah, right.
But what does the lion explain to him?
He has to get undressed.
You have to be undressed before you can go in. So what does that make Eustace think of?
Shedding
skin like a snake.
Yeah.
So he starts working at it, and he's chewing, and he's biting, and he's clawing, and what happens? He removes like a skin, almost like a, there's an empty dragon next to him, and he feels a sense of relief, but he's still
a dragon.
There's more skin. So he goes again.
Yeah.
Chews and claws and scratches and bites, and he pulls it off, and then still a dragon. There's more layers of skin. What is the solution? He cannot undress himself.
The lion says, let me
You have to let me undress
yes.
you.
Yeah. I must undress you. And so,
I said, and it hurts when it does. When he does.
So what happens?
Yeah.
Describe how the lion undresses him.
Well, first of all, he laid down flat on his back.
Mm-hmm. Just let him do it.
Yeah. The very first.
The first tear
was
so
deep,
I thought it had gone right into my heart.
Probably that. It hurt worse than anything.
When it began pulling the skin off, hurt worse than anything I ever felt. And he's got that kind of weird, painful pleasure thing about kind of like thinking about a scab.
Picking his skin off.
And when all the skin is gone, what is it like in comparison to the skin he's been able to take off?
Oh, this is the real thing.
Thicker. Yeah, way
darker.
Thicker and darker.
Yeah.
And it's like all those layers that he could not never have gone through, the lion has gone through with one swipe and pulled it off him.
He was so tender that it hurt.
And so, what happens next? Now he is tender and raw.
Let's go in the water.
We got in the water. And he found that the pain was gone. I felt so good.
And why was the pain gone?
He was a boy again.
Because he was a boy.
Yeah.
He was a boy. Even glad for his puny boy arms that weren't much to look at, but they were his, by golly. And it was so good because he thought he would never see them again.
Father David, wouldn't it be, make me think of the journey of the soul, is that you can try to pick away at things and clean yourself or your soul, whatever, and it doesn't work until you let God do it for you, and sometimes that can be extremely painful.
So, what has happened is that Eustace, the dragon boy with dragon thoughts and a dragon heart, has now been baptized.
Been transformed and baptized.
Oh,
he's
been baptized.
Yeah, right. I never thought of that.
Okay.
That's right.
Put all this together, the dragon thoughts and the dragon heart that's transformed him from the outside in, the inside out, into this dragonish creature, a creature who is fearful and terrible and lonely and set apart. And it takes not his own doing, but, you know, Christ cuts him all the way down to the heart and removes the sin and stain. And he is baptized in the water. And when he comes up, he is given new garments.
Yes.
This is, even in its setting, very purposeful and very deliberate to be evocative of the baptism within the ancient church. In the ancient church, where it was possible, and it wasn't possible everywhere, but where they, you know, places where they were, you know, peaceful and permissible and all that, I've already mentioned it's stuff like the Great Easter Vigil, that would be the day of baptism, and catechumenates, those who were learning the faith, would study all year long, and they would be dismissed before the Eucharist in a service until they were finally baptized. It would take at least a year, and so they would be, it would happen on the Great Easter Vigil. And so this is how it would go. They would have all of their clothing removed, and they would be anointed with oils. And the baptismal font was set into the ground, and there were steps. And you took 7 steps to get down, were submerged, and you took 7 steps to get up. And when you came up, they put a white robe on you, your baptismal garment, showing that the blood of Christ had made you a new creation, and you received communion for the first time. So this is, you know, one of the neatest and most interesting visions of baptism. And he has absolutely and positively been baptized. Does he understand everything that's happening? No. But is he willing? Again, think about all the things that have happened. He meets this figure who he does not understand, who he instinctively fills him with a sense of awe and dread. And what is he supposed to do? Follow me. You know, what is the command of Jesus? Follow me. And so he wants to find relief for his condition of pain, but in order to do that, he must first be undressed. He must be undressed from all of the sin, all of the life, all of the problems, all the pain, all of the rottenness that he's had. He cannot do it himself, no matter how hard he tries. But Christ is able to remove even the deepest layers all the way into the inner parts of our soul. And then in baptism, even if we're raw, we are cleaned and made new. And all the things that he never appreciated before, they're all back. And you're clothed in this baptismal garment, and he's a boy again, he's alive. And the sentence of the dragon was death. You know, he couldn't even go on the journey anymore.
Right. Yeah, right.
This was going to be a life sentence for him. And now he has been restored. He has been redeemed. It is as clear of an explanation of baptism that I've ever seen in fiction. And beautiful in the way that it is, it's kind of framed and it's sort of explained through these other things. You know, it's one of the reasons why I have no great yearning for a believer's baptism, and I'm perfectly content to baptize infants. I think it is scripturally supportable, but when you start talking about, well, you have to have a certain level of rationality to be able to say, I want to be baptized and understand it, and blah, blah, blah. Suddenly, you're drawing arbitrary lines. How old is old enough? How much knowledge is sufficient? Who makes that judgment?
They all decided.
And so, I have no problem with the sense of, you know, you have this older child who's never been baptized, you say, I want to be baptized, I want to follow Jesus, I want to be part of it. Oh, great, wonderful, I will do that. And I, you know, baptized 17 people on the beach, and all but two of them could answer for themselves. However, baptism is a sacrament of God, not a work of man. Meaning, it's not about how much we know and understand. It is about God's grace given to us. Baptism is our response to the gospel, but that response is a receptive one. I'm receiving what you're giving me. And nobody knows everything about baptism. You know, if God could give us a final exam about baptism, and only those who knew enough, you know, who knows enough? I don't feel like my knowledge of baptism is exhaustive. I am a trained theologian. I am an experienced pastor. I have baptized many people, been baptized myself almost my entire life. But there's still plenty of things that I don't understand about it. There's, you know, the mechanics and the theology and all this sort of stuff that's ultimately, remember, sacrament, it comes from the Latin, but in the Greek, the original word used in the New Testament is mysterion, mystery. When you hear sacrament, think of the word mystery. These are holy mysteries. Eustace doesn't really know what's going to happen or what's going on. Eustace is not coming to his, you know, kind of mature proclamation of faith in Aslan. He's just willing to do what he's told. Aslan says, follow, and he follows. Aslan says, you must undress, and he tries. Aslan says, I must undress you, and he simply lays down and does it. So, this is a very beautiful and a very moving picture of not just the act of baptism, but its work and its understanding. And he comes back, not just a new boy, but he comes back alive.
And to point out that whether it's there in the next chapter is that Eustace is not, even after baptism, he's not perfect. He really does become Eustace again at times.
He has his moments.
But he now has the strength and the courage to change.
That's right. And it's even mentioned somewhat specifically that that's not to say that he was completely different, but it is to say he was becoming different.
Becoming.
He didn't know who Aslan was. Edmund talked to him.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. And this is, this is one of the most moving parts of the story for me. The baptism scene is very, very beautiful and very rich, and especially to think of what a rotten kid Eustace was, what a snotty little brat. But of all the people he tells the story to, who does he sit down and tell it to? To Edmund. And Edmund says, "You were just an ass. I was a traitor."
Yeah.
And these two young men, these two boys growing into men, who have more than anyone else in these stories received the grace of Aslan, the grace of Christ. That Edmund doesn't try to diminish anything that Eustace has done or dismiss what's happened to him. You know, Aslan died on the stone table for the sake of Edmund, and he will never forget that.
And I think Edmund's response to Eustace's question, who is Aslan, do you know him? And Edmund saying, well, he knows me.
Mm-hmm. And that is a beautiful statement of
our relationship with God.
Number one, the humility of we cannot fully understand God. Our finite minds are incapable of doing so. But number two, at my best and at my worst, Aslan knows me.
Yeah.
You know, I get a very Jesus loves me, this I know.
Yeah.
Right. I like this. Okay, so how does this little adventure end?
Coming to the camp and everybody's
rejoicing. They get ready to set off. Before they set off, Caspian kind of makes a monument.
Yes.
So that if anyone else were to ever come by, they would know. It kind of honors the death of Lord Octesian, and then what happens at the tail end? Eustace didn't want that armband anymore.
No.
Remember, this armband has caused so much trouble, but
right.
He loved it
yeah.
because it was gold and it was going to make him
yeah.
powerful, and he could get what he wanted and go live like a king somewhere. And he's, I don't care what happens. And he gives it to Caspian, and Caspian simply just tosses it where it will go, and it hooks in the perfect spot on the rock where perhaps it will stay until the world ends. All right. We've got two narrow escapes still to do. We spent a lot of time on that baptism, so let's see where we go with this. They come to the next island. What's on that next island?
Pretty much nothing.
Maybe the dragon ate the people. Maybe pirates killed them and burned all the stuff. They name it Burnt Island. You know, so they're making maps as they go, and they're making they're keeping records, and so this is what they found, and off they go. Now,
they found
a little boat, and who was the boat perfect for?
Reepicheep.
It's like it must be like a child's boat or something. But it's perfect for Reepicheep, so they go ahead and bring it on board. As they sit off, they are away now from Burnt Island, still heading off into the unknown. And what happens next?
More bad weather.
Is there bad weather? We get a little bit of the disagreeable nature of Eustace, a little bit of rain.
Back again.
But that's not the narrow escape.
Oh,
what do they notice? A sea serpent. It first starts off with a few lumps and bumps in the ocean. It catches up to them. And then what happens when they actually meet a sea serpent?
It wraps itself around the ship.
All right. So this thing is huge.
Yeah, right.
And this thing seems deadly. And before they know it, it's lifted itself off of the water over the boat and gone back underneath. So what's going on?
He's making a loop, and it's a tight side. He can just strike that boat.
He's gonna smash the boat and then pick off the survivors floating one by one. And who was the first to do something?
Eustace.
Oh yes, when
he grabs a sword. Everyone's just stunned. Eustace grabs a sword, runs to it, hats it away. Does it do any good?
No. But at least he tried something.
But it shows good more than does good.
But he broke it.
So it didn't really accomplish anything other than to maybe demonstrate that Eustace really is a different sort of kid.
Yeah.
There's a bravery and a courage in him. There is a desire to defend the people that he cares for in him. A bunch of things that he never would have done 2 weeks before.
And it motivates the rest of them.
And everybody else. It sort of wakes them up. And they start hacking and whacking. It's not doing much good. Who figures out what to do?
Rinpoche.
For the first time, Rinpoche just says, don't fight.
Push.
So they get the idea that as this loop is starting to close, if they can push it past the boat, they can get out of the knot before it tightens. And what happens?
It works,
but just barely.
Yeah.
Matter of fact, it snaps off the carved end of the boat.
Oh, yes, it does.
And before the sea serpent can figure out what's going on, they've caught a wind and they're far away. And the sea serpent just kind of is grinning like an idiot, thinking that it's destroyed this ship.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, there's one narrow escape. What's the second narrow escape?
That was with the pool, where things turn
gold. Okay, so now we've gone to another island. We've made it past the sea serpent, and so we have come to, it says it takes three or four days, and there is now... the wind has really picked up, but they spot land. So Drini and the captain, who is experienced, wants to use that land as cover on the leeward side so the wind doesn't get them. And they see a couple of streams, and here's our chance to refill our fresh water.
Right. And
so what do they do?
Well, the one way, and they want to go one way, and they
right. Yeah, there's a little disagreement here. The experienced sea captain wants to go in one direction, and everybody else wants to go
the other way.
And then they found
out. Who turned out to be right?
Darren.
The other people.
Yeah. If they had done what Drinian suggested, they would have gone right into the gold water.
Right, yeah.
Instead, they were able to get fresh water, and as they are exploring, what do they find?
They
see another pool, which is where the source of the other spring, or the source of the other stream. And what do they find outside of the pool?
Well, they find that
clothing
from a fighter.
Clothing.
Yeah.
So they find armor. They find the rotted out scraps of clothing, and they're trying to figure what's going on. So what are some of the possibilities?
Well, they figure that it's one of the lords, because there's something on, is it on the helmet or something? There's a sign that that it belonged to.
They find they find some things that identify it as Narnia.
Yeah.
So it makes sense that this would be one of the lords. And what do they think has happened?
There was a fire.
Okay, some kind of fight maybe.
Yeah, but nobody was killed.
But there's no bones. So who would kill someone in a fight, take the body away, and leave all the stuff? That doesn't make any sense.
No.
What kind of animal would be able to remove chainmail and eat a body, bones and all? Not even a dragon, as Eustace points out. It's quite impossible, I know. So as they're trying to figure out this riddle, what do they notice about the pool?
There's a statue at the bottom.
There's a statue. What's the statue of?
A statue.
A person.
A person.
Yeah.
A person with arms raised up. Like I almost imagine there's an underwater statue in John Pennycamp Park down in Key West.
Oh, really?
Of Jesus, like underwater, and it's very, very beautiful, and it's a big snorkeling and scuba site. But what's notable about this statue?
Gold.
It looks gold.
It's gold.
And it looks perfect.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So what's the problem with going and getting it?
First,
they figure out that it's deep. And if this really is gold, who could possibly lift all this? So in figuring out how deep, what do they do? He's dipping a spear in, and what do they note?
It turns
gold.
You can't pull it out.
Yeah, see, interestingly enough, before he can get it out, they say, oh, it's just a trick of a light. Because look, your spear under the water looks the same as the statue until he drops it because it's so heavy. So then what happens?
He's too close to the water and toads of infantility.
Now, King Edmund the Just has now told everyone to get back. Edmund has figured it out. What's going on?
Well, whatever goes in the water turns to gold.
And he demonstrates that by, say, looking at the tips of my boots. The water, just the edge of the water has touched them and has turned them into gold. No one touched this stuff. And they start realizing they've had a really close call. Anyone at any time could have
just
jumped in, fallen in, touched it on accident.
Tried to drink.
As a matter of fact, they were about to drink when they see this other stuff that kind of takes away their attention.
Yeah.
So, you know, they were very close to some real danger.
And take a spree of heather.
Okay. So who does that?
I don't remember.
Caspian does.
Okay.
He's the king. So I'm gonna do a little kingly experiment. This will be safe. He takes a sprig of heather and he dips it in, and what happens? Beautiful, solid, soft, heavy, real gold. And then what happens?
Well, they realize that it's a person down there.
Okay. They realize that was one of these lords. One of these lords who probably, you know, dove in.
Got hot, took his clothes off, and threw himself in.
But now with water that's so enchanted it can turn anything to gold, thoughts start occurring to them. What kind of thoughts? It's not a curse at first. As a matter of fact, they've proclaimed it gold water. And the king who controls gold water would be the wealthiest king. Think of all the things you could dip in. You get free gold forever.
So he claims it for, Caspian claims it for Narnia, but then they start arguing.
Why? Why are they arguing?
Well, Edmund says, I'm no subject of yours.
Which is actually true.
Yeah, I'm one of the four ancient sovereigns of Narnia.
He's big chief.
And you're under allegiance to my...
And so what's... And how does Caspian respond?
So it has come to that.
He grabs a sword.
Yeah.
Okay, so... When... You know, whether it's reading history or watching old TV shows or movies about prospectors or the Gold Rush or up in Alaska or in San Francisco or wherever, what is gold fever?
Greed.
It is greed. It's pure and simple greed. It does something to you and it drives you crazy. Just the possibilities and the potential of something so valuable, and, you know, people stole and people murdered and people ruined lives and ruined their own lives. People left family and friends to chase after it and, you know, squandered their lives or died in the attempt. There is something about this enchanted pool which initially looks amazingly beautiful, but starts to take a very dark and sinister turn. The legend about King Midas.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Everything he touched turned to gold.
Now, he asked for that, and he got it. But why was he so unhappy?
Because it was his daughter.
Because it was miserable, first of all.
Yeah, well,
turned out that he couldn't eat anything.
There
came a part where he had plenty of gold, but he couldn't stop. And then the most tragic part is he touches his daughter.
Yeah.
And now she has turned to gold and she is lost to him forever.
Yeah.
And so the kind of point of the story is A, be careful what you wish for, and B, that the kind of the end product of greed is destruction and loss. By trying to always gain more, you can actually lose everything that's truly precious. And so they start arguing and fighting and squabbling over this golden pool, and they might have come to blows or even gone to murder. What happens? What stops it?
Lucy.
Well, Lucy tries to stop it. Stop, stop, stop!
Everybody looked up and they saw the figure up on the
aha.
On the hill.
So,
and it was Aslan.
The cure for the greed
was
Aslan. Is
Aslan.
Yeah.
And by
he says bye Aslan.
he's nowhere near him. He's on a hillside.
Yeah.
He seems enormous. Everyone just sort of stops immediately. They don't even have to say Aslan to all know it's Aslan. And then what happens? It's like they're waking up. It's like they were enchanted just being around the pool.
Right.
It wasn't just the enchantment within the pool. And that enchantment of greed is now broken.
Gaspian recognizes
and they,
the
oh,
rich
boy.
Chimes in.
Yeah, they all realize just not only how foolish they've been, but how dangerous this has all been.
And they all decided
it is not... It's not the sort of enchantment you want. It is a curse. This is a dark and evil enchantment. And so the name is changed from Goldwater to
Deathwater.
Now, if they come back to Narnia and they have on these new navigation charts and maps they've made something called Goldwater, what's going to happen?
Everybody's going to
go.
Everybody's
going to go.
But if you put death water in there,
death
go
water,
there.
And now people won't even be interested. They won't be tempted, because that's what it is. This is a curse of temptation.
Yeah.
And they have been able to break free of the curse, but not through their own efforts. Once again, this is through wrestling.
Yeah. So they figure the guy just took his clothes off and jumped in because it wasn't.
And that's all it took.
Yeah.
And that's all it took. So.
And they had not much to tell for the memory of the last hour.
And it all just sort of fades away.
I can actually think of the Tower of Babel, in a way.
Yeah. With that, you know, they truly were enchanted, I think. And that as that enchantment is broken by Aslan, it just sort of fades into the background. Very fuzzy, like a dream. So, at the end of the chapter, we can take count. How many lords have been found?
Three.
Lord Byrn is now the Duke of the Lone Isles. He was the first
one.
That's
right. Yeah. Yeah. All right, the Duke.
Okay. Lord Octesian.
That's the dragon. He either got killed by the dragon or became the dragon.
Yeah, was either eaten by the dragon or became the dragon. The third one is whoever has been turned to gold at the bottom of his pool. Unnamed at this point because they've not figured out. There was nothing on his clothing to identify specifically which lord, but because the stuff was at least Narnian, it's obviously one of them.
So they have four more.
They have four more to go. And so they get ready to set sail, and all of a sudden, hey, we've only had a couple of little adventures here, and we're almost halfway through finding these guys. What's going to happen?
We'll
hey, this is a breeze!
We're down there for New Year's.
Yeah, so suddenly this is starting to look pretty easy. You know, every time we stop, we find a new one. So all we have to do is stop, say, four more times, we'll be good to go.
Yeah, we'll be good. Yeah.
And then we'll
all right. Okay, so 9 and 10, 9 and 10 next time, and we're starting to kind of move towards a conclusion here.